In the spirit of reconciliation, Myeloma Australia acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to the elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. Welcome to My Conversations, Myeloma Australia's podcast series. These podcasts are written and produced by our myeloma support nurses for people living with myeloma, their family and friends. We aim to deliver interesting and up-to-date information on myeloma in a portable and convenient way through our podcast shows.
So welcome everyone to this episode of My Conversations, a Myeloma Australia podcast. My name is Nella Coombe and I'm the Manager of Nursing and Patient Services at Myeloma Australia, and I'm very, very pleased to be your host today. Emeritus Professor Doug Joshua was a consultant haematologist at the Royal Prince Alfred in Sydney for 45 years, starting his journey there and his roles there as a medical student in 1968. Doug framed RPA's reputation as a world-class research institute. Doug is an emeritus professor at the University of Sydney and was head of haematology at RPA. Doug started the myeloma research unit and myeloma therapy unit and played a part in transforming the treatments of blood cancers. He was pivotal in bringing clinical trials to Australia and brought the first myeloma study to our country, which has just grown and grown since then. We've just been talking about that. Doug has a particular interest in immunity and myeloma, vaccinations, severe infections, and seeing how patients respond to their therapy and why they respond in particular ways. So welcome, Doug.
Thank you very much, Emma. I'm delighted to be here.
So your interest in myeloma started many years ago when you were studying in Oxford in 1970. You completed your PhD on immunity and myeloma in experimental murine model. Can you tell us more about this early time and how you got into myeloma?
Well, it is very interesting. I was a young hematologist back in the late 60s and early 70s. And like all young hematologists of that stage, we were interested in leukemia. Myeloma was a non-event in those days. We had no real good treatment for it. And I actually thought I was going to Oxford to work on leukemia. Communications weren't that easy in those days, and you'd write letters, and 6 weeks later you'd get a letter back. But I actually thought I was working on immunity in leukemia. I got there, I met my supervisor, and there is a poem from Frost, which I'm sure you know about, the road less travelled. Yes. Two roads diverged in a world, and I took the one less travelled by, and that made all the difference. I got there, I was given a mouse with a plasmacytoma, and I was said, this is the mouse model you're going to work on, and that was that. And I suddenly realised that I was no longer going to work on leukemia, that I was going to work on myeloma. And we spent 2.5 years doing the experiments, working on immunity in myeloma, and there were some very interesting things that came about in these murine models, which probably reflect the human disease in lots of ways. The murine experiments clearly showed that the major defect in myeloma was the response to the first time patients or these mice were exposed to a new antigen. They had the inability to respond to a new antigen, but had they had antibodies before and been exposed to an antigen, they were able to mount some sort of response. So it's that difficulty in meeting the primary immune response, which is still the major defect in this murine model and also in human myeloma. So we had a wonderful time in Oxford. It's a very special place, as you realise. It's one of the oldest universities in the world. Started really in the 11th century. Its charter was 1248 by Henry II, and it's got a very interesting set up. It's not a university as we understand it. It's a collection of colleges, 39 colleges. We were very fortunate to be assigned to Wolfson College, which was a postgraduate college, because my wife was with me and we had two young children. And as a postgraduate college, we only dealt with postgraduates, not with you know, 17, 18, 19-year-olds who were
fresh out of high school.
So look, we had a wonderful time there. My wife did a master's in mathematics education, and I finished my PhD, and it was really one of the nice times of our life.
Wow, that
and,
sounds great.
I think it just introduced me into myeloma, and from then on, when I came back, I decided that I would continue to work on myeloma and immunity. It was a vacant field, as you would understand, and there was no research. In fact, even at that stage, there was very little research in the whole of Australia on myeloma. And certainly in my hospital, it was essentially a very much service-driven department that had very little research associated with it.
And can I ask a few more questions about this time? Do you mind?
Yeah, sure.
When before you got to Oxford, had you been working as a clinical haematologist, or were you in research first, or were they separate, or did they kind of form together?
Now, look, I've always had an interest in research. I took a year off and did a BSc honours during my medical career, and I actually worked on binocular vision. In fact, my first paper was published in 1970 on binocular vision, and it's still actually being cited today because it was one of a group of papers that described the neurological basis of binocular vision. So I've always been interested in research. When we left for Oxford, I just finished the fellowship of the College of Physicians, and I'd done the exams of the College of Pathologists. So I finished all the exams, and I wanted to spend the last 2 years of my training in research. Mm-hmm. And at that stage, immunology was the research, you know, forefront of all research, and I was very keen to pursue immunology. I was lucky enough to get a Nuffield scholarship, so our airfares and our expenses were paid and college fees were paid in Oxford, and you know, it actually worked very well. It was a great time of our lives. We had two little children, and they all went to school in Oxford, and it worked very well. But research has always been one of the main things I've been interested in. It's sort of part of your DNA in lots of ways, and I was clearly wanted to have an academic career. I didn't want to have a clinical career alone. And it really, when I came back, and I came back to an Australian hospital where research was not considered prime time, as it were, it took a while to gradually work through and develop research plans, develop research protocols, and get grants and publish. And while it took some years, it was a very interesting time. And, you know, then we developed the clinical trial program. I think I was chief investigator for Myeloma 1, 2, 3, and 4, I think. And those trials went ahead. And especially Myeloma 3, which was the interferon study, was a national study. And we were very pleased with that.
Fantastic. And so at that time when you came back to Australia, how were we treating myeloma then? And then how did you see that develop during that time and change because of these trials and this new research and learning more about the disease and how it behaves?
Well, the truth of the matter is we weren't treating myeloma. We were using melphalan, which, as you know, is a derivative of nitrogen mustard gas. Melphalan was synthesized in about 1953. The first trials using melphalan in humans were not trials, they were just clinical reports. First, in 1958, 6 patients were treated in the UK and 3 responded, and that were the first trial. So from 1958 right up until the mid-80s, we were using melphalan to treat myeloma. There was lots of discussion at that time whether combination therapy could be better than melphalan alone. None of those clinical trials really showed that much better than melphalan, but that was the time when we developed PCAB, the program we used, as part of that international effort to use combination therapy in the treatment of myeloma. And there's no doubt that PCAB and some combination therapies, especially using Adriamycin, like in VAD, are very effective in some conditions, but the effects tend to be more temporary than permanent. So from the early 60s right up until the mid 80s, various combinations of melphalan were used, but we had no bone strengthening agents. We had no bisphosphonates. Pain control was poorly done. Bone disease was a terrible blight on our patients, who all ended up with multiple fractures. It was really a very difficult time. In the mid-80s, high-dose melphalan was introduced by Tim McElwain in the UK. And suddenly, for the first time, we got what appeared to be complete remissions. Mm. We know they weren't complete remissions.
And what was that like?
Went back to having normal blood counts. They became asymptomatic. But high-dose melphalan was associated with a lot of toxicity. I mean, if I think back to the initial studies when the complete remission rate was about 20%, but the mortality rate was about 15% from high-dose melphalan, because there was no stem cell rescue carried out. It was just treatment. But the realization that myeloma, in fact, could be treated started in that era. And high-dose melphalan and subsequently stem cell rescue as autologous transplantation has actually been the mainstay of a lot of myeloma therapy, and it still is the mainstay of therapy despite all the new advances that have occurred. Melphalan is still used, as you know. There's been even developments of melphalan with melflufen, which is a derivative of melphalan, which is actually enhanced into malignant cells which contain enzymes, which aminopeptidases, which allow the melphalan to be introduced into the cell. And it clearly is effective and effective in melphalan-resistant patients, but unfortunately, as you know, was removed from the market because of increased toxicity. So there is still avenue for in using melphalan derivatives, but melphalan, other than its use in high-dose therapy, has really dropped out of the scene in myeloma. But we stood there. There was a flurry of activity with interferon, which also does, in some patients, cause some response. But in the big picture, and even in our trial, showed some effect in prolonging remission, but not a major effect. Probably the introduction of the bisphosphonates was a major advance because suddenly this terrible bone disease and bone destruction was ameliorated, and we were and it was one of the major things in terms of quality of life of patients with myeloma. So I think the introduction of the bisphosphonates really tends often to be overshadowed by CAR T cells and things, but was a major advance in reality
for and myeloma. Huge. Huge.
So that was the stage until the introduction of the IMIDs and the proteasome inhibitors. So we were treating with high-dose therapy, we were treating with bisphosphonates, that's about all we had.
And to be able to see that change that it made to people's outcomes and quality of life would have been quite
amazing
and inspiring, and as a clinician.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And also with the research component, thinking about how that has translated to better outcomes and better control of people's myeloma.
Absolutely. And that's why myeloma has moved from a orphan disease to a star disease. And that's why the interest in myeloma is just incredibly accelerated from the turn of the century, when both IMIDs and thalidomide and Revlimid and pomalidomide have been introduced, and then the proteasome inhibitors were introduced, we are seeing survivals and responses and complete remissions, which when I started, we would only dream about. We never actually considered were possible. In fact, we were taught that they were not possible. It just shows you how the things that you're taught when you're a medical student are mostly incorrect, because things have changed so much. Yeah. So now we're in a very favourable state with myeloma. We've got, you know, we've got the IMiDs and the proteasome inhibitors, and now we're in the era of the immune therapies, and that's going to revolutionise disease.
And thinking back to that time when, you know, we were using melphalan primarily and steroids, to then bringing in IMiDs and proteasome inhibitors, what was happening behind the scenes? How did we get to that point from going from a standard chemotherapy sort of type agent to something utilizing the immune system, or being very specific in the way that it interacts with the myeloma cell?
Well, you know the story of thalidomide. Thalidomide was considered an anti-angiogenic agent. There was a patient in the States who contacted the angiogenesis expert and whose husband had myeloma, and said, why can't we use thalidomide in myeloma? And she apparently hacked her doctors in Arkansas to give him thalidomide. And lo and behold, there was this dramatic response. And they published four patients or so. Singal was the first author, and that, not four patients, Singal was the first author, but they published their first series of thalidomide. And I remember the whole discussion about, well, why can't we use thalidomide because of the teratogenesis, and how controls we're going to have to put in, and thalidomide will get in the community. Of course, it was all overrated. Thalidomide didn't get in the community, but there were very strict controls on its use of thalidomide, and there were some cases of thalidomide being used inappropriately, I must admit. But once thalidomide was introduced, the whole world changed, because here you had a non-cytotoxic drug that was effective in myeloma. And as you know, Andrew Spencer-Rand, our Australia study on thalidomide showed prolongation of remission. And it really allowed mainly the Boston group, with help from drug pharmaceutical industries, to develop a whole lot of IMiDs, or modulatory drugs, which are akin to thalidomide but different from thalidomide. And at the same time, the proteasome inhibitors were being developed. We were very interested in the mechanism of the action of the proteasome inhibitors. But they do work in myeloma, because the myeloma cells are producing so much protein. And by blocking their proteasome, you get accumulation of protein, and you get cell death associated with a toxic accumulation of protein. And we published some papers on XBP1 with one of my PhD students, which really showed that this was with a mechanism of how these proteasome inhibitors worked. And I remember talking to Paul Richardson, because I was in Boston for a sabbatical. I've had a couple of sabbaticals, one in Birmingham and one in Boston. But I was in Boston for a sabbatical, and he was saying, I want to use these two drugs together for VRD, essentially. And the problem is not using the drugs together. The problem is getting the two different drug companies to work together so we can use these drugs together in a big clinical study. But Paul being Paul, and being the very affable guy that he is, managed to convince the companies. They worked together, and VRD was born. And suddenly we have 80% response rates, 90% response rates in patients with myeloma. Mm-hmm. And that was the mid-200s, about 2005, 2006. I was in Boston in 2007 when I was introduced. The first time I was introduced to it was 2007, when I was working with Paul in the clinic. So that was a very exciting time. And we were, you know, initially the response rate was 100%. Now we know it clearly couldn't stay at 100%, but it was a very, very exciting time at that stage. At the same time, there's been all this understanding and development and molecular development going on in the background, which really enabled us to enhance the understanding, the minimal residual disease studies. All these things happened all at the same time, and it resulted in gigantic leaps in myeloma care and myeloma therapies.
Mm.
I can't underestimate also the value of the palliative care and the nursing palliative care and pain control, which suddenly occurred. It suddenly became a major factor. I mean, you can't imagine prior to palliative care, prior to specialist nurses, there was no pain control system. You used morphine and patients were overdosed with morphine or underdosed with morphine. It was not really a very pleasant time for patients. It's quite different now.
Thanks so much, Doug. We're going to take a quick break now and we'll be back shortly. Do you want to speak with a myeloma nurse with a wealth of knowledge about myeloma? Myeloma Australia's telephone support line is available Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Australian Eastern Time. Call 1-800-MYELOMA or 1-800-693-566 and a specialist myeloma nurse will answer your call in confidence. Welcome back to My Conversations. I'm Nella Coombe and I'm with Emeritus Professor Doug Joshua discussing the history of myeloma. It really, one of the things that I love working in myeloma and in hematology is the team, the way that the team works and everybody plays their part, and not just within the hospital, but what you've been talking about around the world, there is this incredibly passionate community that want to collaborate and want to see advances and see improvements. And it is a very inspiring and rewarding field to work in.
Yeah, and no, I agree. Absolutely. I agree. It's been good. Yeah. And I think we've done a lot for myeloma, much more so than for a lot of other diseases compared to, I know we started at a very low level, but we've certainly done a lot for myeloma, and that's reflected in when I went to my first ASH meeting in 1983, first time I went to an ASH meeting, myeloma and CLL were given half a session on the last afternoon of the meeting. That was the interest in myeloma and CLL. And now CLL also, which has had major advances, like myeloma, have become star diseases, certainly no longer orphan diseases.
Are there times when you just pinch yourself and think, how have we got to this point? Or, you know, is this real? It's a bit of a random question, but I thought I wanted to ask it.
Well, you do pinch yourself. I mean, I'm not treating patients anymore, as you know. And even since when I stopped treating patients, there are now things which I cannot believe have occurred. I mean, daratumumab was introduced just as I was leaving. So I have prescribed daratumumab. I certainly have never prescribed a CAR T cell or a BiTE or a antibody conjugate, because all these things have occurred after I stopped seeing patients. And I'm just amazed. I mean, I do keep up with the myeloma literature. I don't keep up with anything else, I must admit. But I'm just amazed at how these things have just seemed to be every day. There's a new antibody drug conjugate or a new BiTE cell or a different CAR T cell. And I mean, while I'm still involved in my department, so I see these things happening, I'm obviously not directly involved in a patient sense. But it is wonderful to see. Mm. Wonderful to see.
That's great. We've talked a lot about the treatments and we'll probably come back to that as the conversation evolves, I imagine. But can you tell us a little bit about the tests and how they've evolved for myeloma, like the serum electrophoresis, the way that we look at the proteins, and the tests that we use to diagnose and monitor myeloma?
So sure. So I think one of our major advances in understanding myeloma is understanding response. I mean, until we understood that the response of the paraprotein and the light chains actually reflected a clinically meaningful situation, which led along to minimal residual disease activity. We really didn't have much of a hand on how to measure response other than just looking at tumor reduction, white cell count improvement, and things like that. The history of the light change is quite interesting. As you probably know, that the first case of myeloma was described in the 1840s, and it was well described because Henry Bence Jones, Proteinuria, actually investigated the urine of this gentleman whose name was Mr. McBean, believe it or not. He investigated and he realized that the Bence Jones protein had the particular property of when you heated it, dissolved, and when it cooled, it recoagulated. So that was, and believe it or not, they were still doing that test when I was a medical student. But subsequently, with the understanding of light chains, the understanding that the light chain were the same as the same light chains in the urine were the light chains associated with immunoglobulin, really understood that this was a unique marker for myeloma. These days, with Greek alphabets being very common because of COVID, it's quite interesting to appreciate that the kappa and lambda of myeloma light chains was actually named after the discoverers of the light chains, whose names were Korngold and Lipari. So the kappa was named after Korngold and the lambda was named after Lipari. She was a science technician. Korngold was a PhD a doctor. And they described that in 1956, which is not that long ago in reality. I was 10 years old then, let's face it. So it wasn't that long ago. And in 1962, it was actually appreciated that we were looking at a unique marker of myeloma. The immunoglobulin and the light chains could be assayed. Nobel Prize went to the discoverer of assaying of immunoglobulins. And, of course, Waldenström's, who missed out on a Nobel, described IgM and Waldenström's macroglobulinemia. So in the early 60s or the mid-60s, it became obvious that an IgG kappa, the kappa light chains in an IgG kappa were the same as the kappa light chains in immunoglobulin. So we now had a measure of production of immunoglobulin, and it then became appreciated that measurement of that was a reflection of tumor response. This was a tumor marker, and it was a idiotypic tumor marker, which was unique to a patient. So once we understood the tumor response could be measured, the whole spectrum of response to tumor could be assayed, and response criteria were written, and all that said about uniform response criteria, which the myeloma working group wrote and published, have actually now enabled uniform response reporting in clinical trials. And that was, I think, a major advance. That understanding did tell us that you could measure response, but clearly response and a complete remission on this criteria were not good enough. And subsequent development of minimal residual disease assay, initially by molecular techniques and then by flow cytometric techniques, have been a great advance because we now know that the attainment of minimal residual disease really is an excellent prognostic marker, and may even be a way of changing treatments or selecting treatments or reducing toxicity of treatments. So that evolution of response criteria really started in the 60s when we understood about kappa and lambda, we understood about immunoglobulin, and we appreciated that the myeloma cells secreting an immunoglobulin was a marker of disease activity.
Mm. And it will be so interesting to see what happens next with minimal residual disease and how that is refined and explored more and developed and then rolled out, hopefully, to everybody, not just on clinical trials or through select laboratories that are around the country.
Well, I know our lab under Joy has set up a minimal residual disease assay, which we do.
And we do it for a lot of institutions in New South Wales at present. So I think you're right. I think soon everyone will have minimal residual disease. Everyone now apparently will be able to get we'll be able to get their myeloma gene array done. So I think changes are occurring, and I think it's excellent, actually. Excellent. Right.
Excellent. So going back, we didn't talk about the very, very early stages where Dr. Bence Jones was investigating the urine of his patients. But at that time, was that when we were treating myeloma with quinine and orange peel, iron salts? There's a list of different concoctions. Was that at that time, Doug?
It was, but it was, I mean, obviously none of these work. But Bean's quite interesting because his history is quite well described. He fractured a rib, but he then had a period of about 3 or 4 years where he was relatively well. So he obviously went into some sort of stable phase, and then he progressed. But I think in 1889, Kaler, who introduced the term multiple myeloma, actually described cases. And it was called multiple myeloma because there were multiple tumours in the bones. So, I mean, it's not called single myeloma for good reason. It's clearly there were multiple diseases, multiple tumours. So when you think about it, 1889, you know, for 50 years, nothing happened. I guess it was described, nothing happened. Melflam was introduced in the late 50s. They were using another nitrogen mustard derivative, urethane, had been used in myeloma with some responses, but really nothing. It was a, you know, median survival of less than a year. It was a terrible time. And I guess not until, and melphalan treatment alone only increased median survivals for two and a half, 3 years. Nothing compared to the 8, 9, 10 years that we see now with modern therapies.
And what do you see? What's your prediction if you've got a crystal ball? I mean, it's a very educated crystal ball and well informed. And I'm sure those myeloma papers keep you very busy because they just keep coming. What do you think the next 10 years might look like, Doug?
Well, I have thought about what will happen in the next 10 years, and I think, you know, the expression, every cloud has a silver lining. One of the silver linings of COVID has been the development of mRNA vaccines. And I think soon we will have mRNA vaccines for tumours. Mm. So every tumour will be sequenced. Mutations will be identified. Mutations which are considered immunogenic will be turned into an mRNA vaccine, and patients will be individually immunized with their own tumor vaccine. So I think that not only will happen rapidly, I think that will happen certainly within the next 5 years or so. So I think that's probably something that's going to occur. CAR T cells are clearly going to develop, and I think the big change with CAR T cells will be off the shelf CAR Ts, and they will be manipulating with CRISPR CAR Ts so that they don't cause cytokine release syndrome, they don't cause allogeneic reaction. So off-the-shelf CAR Ts will be the next thing that will happen, and that I think that will happen reasonably quickly. Probably, which is something which I've had some interest in is the the role that the microbiome plays. I mean, people used to laugh at this, but there are some hints about the role of the microbiome because there are millions of antigens that we have in our gut, and some of those antigens may well represent tumour antigens. And understanding that, and that may allow people to become immune or to these tumour antigens, refractory to these tumour antigens. So understanding the microbiome may well also lead us into tumour control. Mm. What I would love to see, however, is primary prevention of myeloma, like we've seen primary prevention of lung cancer and cervical cancer. I mean, if we could ever understand the primary cause of myeloma, there may not be one primary cause, but if we can understand the primary cause and we can alter that primary cause by diet or by some other mechanism, I think that will be something that would be fantastic, because we ought to be able to do it. And we do know that diet alters the incidence of cancer, other cancers. So we may well one day be able to identify something in the diet or something that allows that primary cause of myeloma to be reduced. It clearly is an age factor. We know that in the experimental models that we used, interestingly enough, we know that germ-free mice don't develop myeloma. It's obviously in some way related to antigens that you eat or antigens you're exposed to. So we may well be able to do something along those lines. But I think mRNA vaccines against individual tumours are going to happen, and they're going to happen pretty quickly. I think off-the-shelf CAR-Ts or off-the-shelf bites or off-the-shelf drug conjugates will all rapidly develop. And then in the future, we may be able to understand something about the microbiome and cancers in general and cancers in tumour. It's interesting to see. I don't think we can guess. I don't think we have any idea in reality what's going to happen. We won't know. And when you're my age, you'll just look back at the 2020s and say, God, did we treat things like that?
It's so exciting to think about what the future may hold and what we might be talking about in 5-10 years' time if we reconvene this chat.
Absolutely.
So just before we finish up, Doug, are you able to tell us maybe a highlight of your career in myeloma so far?
Well, the highlight of my career, the things that I'm pleased about, if you like, when I look back at what I've done, I'm very pleased that we've converted a department of haematology in Royal Prince Alfred Hospital, which virtually did no sort of laboratory or clinical research, into a very active research department. I mean, it's not me who done it. It's me and my subsequent colleagues, John Gibson and Joy, who've turned the department into a really active research department, as well as providing excellent clinical care. And I think that's been fantastic. I guess the 2005 International Workshop, which we held in Sydney, which is still spoken of as one of the best workshops ever. I get so many comments from people saying, oh, Sydney was fantastic. And it was fantastic. It was a fantastic setting on the harbour. We had good weather. It was at a time when the first Revlimid studies were introduced, I mean, were presented, in fact. So the first Revlimid maintenance study was presented in 2005 at that meeting. So that was a fantastic time, and that was clearly a highlight. On a personal level, I guess we had three wonderful sabbatical times. We were in Oxford, and then we were in Birmingham, and then in Boston. They were great. I thank my wife. We've got a lovely family. We've got 10 grandchildren, which have been highlights of our lives, and my wife's been wonderful and supportive. But in terms of myeloma, I guess it's just been for me that coming into a situation where there was an orphan disease, where no one was interested in it, where people sort of would look at me and say, oh, you're the only one in like at the HSA and Z blood meetings, you're the only one presenting any myeloma research. So I was told many times, oh, you're the only people presenting myeloma research. And seeing myeloma build up in Australia so well, and seeing all the leaders of myeloma currently, a lot of them have been through Prince Alfred as registrars, it's very nice. It's a very nice feeling.
Thank you so much for your contribution to myeloma, Doug. I'll speak on behalf of myself, but I think that many people who will be listening to this podcast will be thinking the same thing. So a big thank you.
No, thank you, Emma.
Yeah, and also thank you for joining us today on My Conversations. We were really thrilled to have you on the show, and we'd love to have you back another time if you'd like to chat with us again.
Yeah, thank you, Emma. It was a pleasure, and I enjoyed it very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of My Conversations. We'd love to hear from you, so send us your questions or topic ideas to our email address, nurses@myeloma.org.au. Whilst the advice and opinions of our guests is welcomed, this podcast provides general information and is not intended to replace medical care or the advice of your treating team. Please talk to your doctor if you have any questions about your diagnosis or treatment. Your doctor can answer your questions, talk with you about your treatment goals, and provide you with extra support.